So you had said that the Buddha would occasionally use the word jhana to say absorbed in
anger,
for example.
Because there's a passage where actually it's this one Brahmin who was a minister of the king was talking to Ananda. And he was saying, this was after the Buddha had passed away. He said, oh yeah, I knew the Buddha. He was a great meditator. In fact, he praised all kinds of jhana. And Ananda says, well, there was some kinds of jhana he did not approve of. Absorption in anger, absorption in greed, that kind of stuff. Absorption in passion.
You got the full text of the bathman and the well back on in section 26. So.
Yeah, okay. You're reading ahead.
I knew I'd seen it.
Yeah. Okay. Third John, with the fading of rapture, you remain equanimous, mindful, and alert, and sense pleasure with the body. You enter and remain in the third jhana, which the noble ones declare equanimous and mindful, he has a pleasant abiding. Okay, there comes a point where rapture actually becomes unpleasant. There's too much energy, there's too much movement, you want the mind wants to settle down to something more quiet and controlled. Back up a bit. Some people actually, on entering the first jhana, really don't like the experience of rapture. These are people I've noticed, it's a psychological issue when it comes down to it. Either they are very controlling, they like to have things a certain way, and that sense of rapture is threatening to their sense of control. The other thing is people who've had experience of near drowning really don't like this, because it reminds them of when they were drowning. I have a student back east who was complaining one time. She says, you know, I've been doing this breath meditation for several years now, and I guess I'm just going to have to stop. I said, well, why? Because I keep breathing and getting settled down. All of a sudden, there's this real sense of fullness in my body. I said, well, yes. And it turned out she'd almost drowned twice. So it's okay. Now you've got to learn how to re-educate yourself on this kind of visceral level. That as long as you're with the body and you're with your breath, you're okay. You're not going to drown. It takes an effort of will, but it can be done. But then after you've had enough of that, and when rapture comes, sometimes it comes in a weak form, sometimes it comes in a strong form. And it's not necessarily a measure of the strength of your concentration, it's more a measure of how much your body needed the energy. If it has a very strong need for energy, when you settle down, boy, their energy comes on strong. And if the need is not so great, you don't notice it that much. But then, as I said, with the third jhana, you come to the point where okay, you've had enough of that, and you want something even quieter. And it's like tuning into a quieter radio station. You've had enough rock, and now you want something easy listening or something. And the reason I use this as an analogy is that you think about the radio waves in the air. That I don't know how many radio stations there are around here. Bellingham and Vancouver and Victoria and Seattle. They're all here in the air right now. And it's simply a question of which one you're going to tend into. In the same place where there's rapture, there's also a stillness which is devoid of rapture. Just like a matter of tuning into a different frequency. And again, the mind is equanimous, but the body feels pleasure. A sense of ease and well-being in the body. And you're focused on that as part of your object, just why this feels really, really good. The analogy here is of a lake with lotuses in the lake, and the lotuses, some of them do not rise up above the water, so the entire lotus plant from the roots up to the tip of the flower are all saturated in the water. Now you notice, see the direction in which these analogies are going. In the first one you actually have a conscious agent moving the energy around. In the second one the energy is flowing without a conscious agent, but there's still water and there's still movement. In the third analogy, there's water, but it's still. You're moving, and it's a good analogy for each of these different states. The water stands for pleasure, the movement stands for rapture, and that conscious agent stands for directed thought and evaluation. And finally, with the fourth jhana, the abandoning of pleasure and pain is with the earlier disappearance of joy and distress. You enter and remain in the fourth jhana, purity of equanimity and mindfulness. neither pleasure nor pain. Okay, at this point, your breathing actually stops. And even though there's a very subtle feeling of pleasure that goes along with the equanimity, you're not even focused on that. Just you're more focused on the clarity and stillness of the mind and the stillness of the body. This is where the Buddha says, is where equanimity becomes pure and even mindfulness becomes pure as well. So you notice as you move from right effort through right mindfulness, each contains the one that came before it. You've got right effort and you've got mindfulness. Right mindfulness includes right effort as ardency. And then right concentration includes right mindfulness as its theme. So all three of these, right effort, right mindfulness, right concentration, go together to get the mind into a state where it's really equanimous, very still. And when it's very still like this, then you can start seeing the movements of the mind. That's how jhana, the absorption like this, becomes a basis for insight. Any questions on those?
Mindfulness is a function of memory, as we talked about earlier. How would that function in jhana?
Just remember, stay with the breath. You're not going to go anywhere else. Questions? Okay, let's break for half an hour. We'll come back at 3:30. Questions that came up during break, I'd like to share them with the group. One is, when you're meditating and there's a strong sense of like your hands have expanded, or some part of your body is unusually large, unusually small, that's a symptom of rapture. One of the things that happens when people are beginning to get into right concentration, there'll be a distortion in your sense of the body. And after a while, that'll finally disappear. Sometimes your body feels extra small, like it's a tiny, tiny little you in this big room. Otherwise, maybe that you fill the room. I was sitting and meditating one time with my teacher, and I had the sense that my body had disappeared, and I was just all head. And there was a woman who was sitting with a John Fung. She came out of meditation at the same time as the group, and she said, I just had a feeling that my head disappeared, and I was all body. Knows what's going on. Second question, when we dedicate merit at the end of the session, who benefits? And first off, of course, you're benefiting by being generous. Secondly, as the Buddha said, there are beings called hungry ghosts who automatically benefit from any merit dedicated to them, and their karma is such that they can receive it. But not every hungry ghost is in a position to receive it, but most of them are, but that's their food. So if you're dedicating to somebody who's hungry ghost, it automatically goes there. For other people, they have to know and approve of what you've done for them to get the merit. Which is why in some of the chants they have for dedicating merit at the end, they say, if they don't know, may the devas inform them. In other words, through a dream or something, may it come to them that someone has dedicated merit to them. And it's in their approving of it that they actually gain merit. Now, there are some beings who will not approve. I knew a guy who was living in an apartment building in Bangkok in a spot that had built over a Christian cemetery. It was near Sathon, which used to be a Christian area. That's where the Westerners used to live in Bangkok. And he had this vision of this nun, Catholic nun, in his apartment several nights in a row. And so he finally decided to dedicate the merit of his meditation to her. And she said, I don't want any of your Buddhist merit. What do you do? There was another case where, in the building where John Fuen taught meditation in Bangkok, there had been a monk who had lived downstairs, and he had had a trade going in Buddha images. In fact, most of the Thai Buddha images that made their way out into the international art market came through him. And he would do his trades at weird hours of the night, 2 a.m., 3 a.m., 4 a.m. People would bring things in. No questions asked, where did you get them, what happened to you? And he had some money in a cash drawer. And technically speaking, he was okay. He didn't touch the money, but he was actually running a business. And John Fuen had been invited in to teach meditation and had moved into the top floor of the building. You know, this monk didn't like that, and for years did everything he could to get rid of John Fuen. Finally, John Fuen was offered the monastery land where I trained in Rayong. And soon after John Fuen left, the monk was found stabbed dead in his room. And then a couple years after that, John Fuen was invited back to teach meditation again, and people started seeing the monk kind of wandering around the building. And they didn't know the background, they didn't know the story, and this happened several different times with people not knowing other people had the same experience. But they always said, there's this bloody monk wandering around the building. And John Fuen would always say, okay, dedicate the merit of your meditation to him. So they'd sit there a few minutes. He wouldn't accept it. So there were some people who were kind of beyond help for the time being. But as the Buddha told this one Brahmin who had asked him about this, I mean, one, if you dedicate merit to your relatives, especially your relatives who passed away, if they're hungry ghosts among your relatives, they'll automatically receive it. Then the Brahmin said, well, what if I don't have any relatives who are hungry ghosts? And he says, don't worry, everybody does. And that's true. The ones who can't receive it, you still gain the merit from having been generous and dedicating it to them. So, those are the questions that came up. Are there any further questions about right concentration, absorption, jhana? Yes?
We develop right concentration to gain insight. Mm-hmm. I know sometimes it happens spontaneously. How about the relationship between the jhanas
and insight?
An insight that doesn't arise spontaneously.
That's the topic for the next session. Thank you. But before we do that, any other questions? I thought that was my hand over here.
Well, the microphone
was able to connect. What's that? Next is the five aggregates again. We come back to the five aggregates. And this is a useful framework to keep in mind when you are trying to analyze what's going on in the mind once you've got the mind settled down. Passage 21, I've already gone over the content here. It's basically, this is where on page 15, passage 21, that these aggregates are activities. They are things that you do. The question always arises, why do they call them aggregates? And this has to do with a term in philosophy that got started around the 17th century. Late 17th, early 18th century, was that when you talk about groups of things, there are two kinds of groups. There are systems, and this includes organic systems like a body, where the different parts all work together for a certain purpose. And then there are aggregates, where things are just kind of lumped together with no particular purpose, kind of random collections of things. And so when they started talking, reading about the khandhas, which is the Pali term for this, they immediately thought, oh, the Buddha is talking about how the fact that what you were made up of is actually random stuff. That you've come together, you've tried to make it into a system, but the stuff itself is random. You're trying to make this into a system, but it keeps falling apart. So there's some use in the word aggregate that's also, I mean, the fact that when you put it together, it does have a purpose. Which indicates that these aren't really aggregates in that sense. And so I'm still waiting to find a better translation. The word in Pali also means heap or group or pile of things. The word kanda is also the word they use for a trunk of a tree. Now, when they talk about clinging, it's not only a word that's used for feeding, like an animal or a plant would feed, but also fire feeds on its fuel. In this case, this is the fuel that gets fed on. It's a trunk of, like a fire burning on the trunk of a tree. So passage 21 points out that they are activities. Remember, in the Satipatthana Sutta, they talked about developing concentration to see the origination and disappearance of form, feeling, perception. Passage 22 explains this. Now, the origination here is not just simply the fact that it arises from something. And what does it arise from? In this case, when you relish these things, welcome them, and are fastened to them. While you are relishing form, welcoming it, remaining fastened to it, delight arises. Any delight in the form is clinging. With that clinging as a condition, there's becoming. From becoming, it goes all the way through pain, distress, and despair. And it applies to all of these, all the aggregates, feeling, perception, fabrications, and consciousness. That word mass, though, that's also another word, another translation of kanda. This is a dukkha kanda, this mass of suffering. So I guess we could call them the five masses, five kundalini masses. What is a disappearance? Okay, when you don't relish these things. So it's not, again, that just forms arise and pass away. It's what is it that makes you cling to them, and it's the delight. Delight, relishing, welcoming, and remaining fastened to these things. The next passage is the one that didn't get a number. Which is Mahagotita is talking to Sariputta. Mahagotita is an arahant, and one of his ways of educating his students, apparently, was to take them to see Sariputta and ask Sariputta questions. Sariputta was a lot more articulate. And the question he's asked there, okay, what is it that you should be doing with the five clinging aggregates? And he says that you should be viewing the five clinging aggregates as in constant, stressful, a disease, a cancer, an arrow, painful, an affliction, an alien, a dissolution, an emptiness, not self. In other words, you see the drawbacks in terms of any of those three perceptions of inconstancy, stress, not self. And you look at the other ones that they're obviously related. Inconstant is also related to dissolution, disease, cancer, an arrow, painful, an affliction, that relates to the stressfulness, and alien, emptiness, and not self are related. And you attend to these things, you see them with these perceptions in mind. And as a result, the first result would be the attaining stream entry, and then it goes on to, and then he says the same thing, what should a stream enter do? Well, you attend to them in the same, with the same perceptions. What should a non-returner do? Non-returner should attend to them with the same perceptions. And finally, with an arahant, how should the arahant attend to them in an appropriate way? And again, this is all aspect of comprehension of suffering. When we talk about the various duties, you try to attend to the hindrances in an appropriate way, i.e. so as to abandon them. You attend to the factors for awakening in an appropriate way so as to develop them. This is so as to comprehend them. And comprehend them means the ways in which they are alien, stressful, not self. In other words, conducive to dispassion. You look at them from that point of view. The arahant does the same. It says, although for an arahant there's nothing further to do and nothing to add to what has been done, still these things, when developed and pursued, lead to both a pleasant abiding in the here and now and to mindfulness and alertness. In other words, this is pleasant for an arahant to see these things this way. Realize we're beyond that finally. Any questions on that passage? Yes, John.
Could you take the aggregate of perception and again kind of walk us through what it would be like to attend in an appropriate way to the aggregate perception as
inconstant, stressful, etc. Okay, your aggregate perception is that you have a certain way of labeling something, and you've noticed, fine, okay, if I label things this way, gives rise to stress. And so you want to see the drawbacks of that particular label. Labeling something is really attractive. And first you learn to look at it, you apply it another perception. But you see this, the label of attractive keeps coming up. So you look at it, okay, why is it there? What am I relishing in this label? And you begin to see, okay, it's actually not, it's inconstant. One, you're seeing that the perception is not inherent in the object. You realize, okay, this is pretty arbitrary that I've just applied this perception there. And then you see, okay, when I apply this perception to that object, there's going to be that. These problems. So look at the process of labeling itself. That it's arbitrary and it's, you don't know where you get these labels from. That's the alien part. And empty is that, you know, you quiz the label and the label doesn't have any real defense. It's just there. That's the way of dealing with it. But what you find out is that you are using perception to overcome perceptions. You're applying a new set of perceptions here. Passage 23 points out that this process of fabrication here has primarily to do with intentions. And 24 gives a list of bodily, verbal, and mental fabrications that we've been talking about all along. Passage 25 is a mistake. It's a repeat of something that came earlier. Passage 26, this is where we start getting into what's important here. Passage 26 goes through the four jhanas, gives the analogies, and then gives what's called a fifth factor to all of this. Look down at the bottom of page 18, after the fourth jhana. It says, further, the monk has his theme of reflection well in hand, well attended to, well considered, well tuned, or well penetrated by means of discernment. Okay, what does that mean? Basically means that you step back and you're watching what's going on in the mind. And this is ability that requires a certain amount of skill. I mean, it's one skill to just get planted into your object and absorbed. It's another skill to be able to pull back a little bit and yet not destroy the concentration. But when you can do that, then you can observe what's going on underneath. When you create a state of concentration, what's going into it? So the analogy here, is if one person were to reflect on another, a standing person were to reflect on a sitting person, or a sitting person were to reflect on a person lying down. And even so, you have your theme of reflection well in hand. In other words, you're able to observe the mind while it's in concentration. Because when the Buddha talks about giving rise to insight while you're in concentration, there are two ways of doing it. One is while you're in concentration, the other is while you're moving from one to the next. Like you move from the second jhana to the third jhana, you begin to notice, oh, I dropped that activity, which you hadn't really been aware that you were doing until you dropped it. This is one of the reasons why I tell people when you're practicing concentration, don't be too quick to label your levels. This is why post-it notes are embedded. You say, this seems to be the first jhana, but I'm not sure. Let's just put a post-it note there and then watch it and see if the mind goes down further, what happens. The mind goes further down, what happens? And you begin to notice, oh, when I went down there, I dropped that activity. When I went down there, I dropped this other activity. And you begin to see the fabricated nature of all this. And that can give rise to, you see the fabrications, and gosh, I just put this stuff together. And that can give rise to a sense of dispassion. That's one way of giving rise to insight. The other is to analyze things while you're in the concentration. That's what this passage is about. And passage 27 actually goes into a lot of detail on that.
So this reflection happens within all the jhanas.
It's not, it can happen reflective. It's almost like the first jhana piggybacking on the others. Because your ability to analyze things, you have to pose a question in the mind, what's going on here? The basic question is here is there any stress? Is there any up and down in the stress in this state? There is, what kind of, what have I been doing? That's what you look for. So here the discussion of Buddha gives in 27. Suppose that an archer or archer's apprentice were to practice on a straw man or mounted clay, so that after all he would become able to shoot long distances, to fire accurate shots in rapid succession, and to pierce great masses. The same way, this case is where one is secluded from sensuality, from unskillful qualities, and it remains in the first jhana. Rapture and pleasure born of seclusion, accompanied by a directed thought and evaluation. You regard whatever phenomena there that are connected with form, feeling, perception, fabrications, and consciousness. Okay, you learn how to see that jhana state as made up of aggregates. These aggregates that you were taught were suffering, you've turned them into a state of concentration. Now remember, we talked about aggregates as being related to the process of feeding. And we've also talked about jhana as being your food. And this is the connection between the two of them, is that your state of jhana is made of, can you say you're focused on the breath. There's the form of the body. There's the feeling of pleasure that you created by focusing on the breath. There's the perception of breath that held you there. There is the fabrication, which could be the directed thought and evaluation, or it could simply be the breathing and perceptions. And then there's the consciousness. So you've got all five aggregates right there. The analogy that I've used in the past is that when you're carrying these things around with, in a way that's causing suffering, it's like having a big sack of bricks on your back that you're carrying around on your shoulder. And when you turn them into jhana, you take the same bricks and you make them into a path. But now the time has come to go beyond the path, so you realize, okay, I'm still carrying these things around in a very subtle way. So again, you apply those perceptions of appropriate attention. You see them as inconstant, stressful, a disease, a cancer, an arrow, painful, an affliction, alien, a disintegration, an emptiness, not self. Okay. You turn your mind away from those phenomena as a result of having analyzed them in terms of those perceptions. And having done so, you incline your mind to the property of deathlessness. This is peace, this is exquisite, the resolution of all fabrications, the relinquishment of all acquisitions, the ending of craving, dispassion, cessation, and bonding. Okay, you use the negative perceptions towards the aggregates in your concentration, those activities that you're doing in the concentration. You say, I've had enough of this. I'd like something unfabricated. That too is another perception. And then staying right there, you actually come to the deathless. So incline your mind in that direction, and you either reach the ending of the effluence, which means become an arahant, or through this very dhamma passion, this dhamma delight, in other words, you start delighting in that quality of deathlessness. You experience it, but you're still attached to it. This is why there are lower levels of awakening and higher levels. In the lower levels, you're still attached, you're now attached to the deathless experience you have. From the total ending of five lower fetters, self-identification views, grasping and habits and practices, uncertainty, sensual passion, irritation, you're due to arise spontaneously in the pure abodes, there and be totally unbound, never again to return from that world. Okay, there are several stages in this. One, you get the mind into concentration. Two, you get really good at it. Three, you learn how to perceive that even that good concentration is something that's not quite constant and reliable. You say, there must be something better. You incline your mind to something that's unfabricated. And as long as you don't latch on to the unfabricated, you can get total awakening. If you do latch on, that's when you have to apply the perception of not self even to that experience. That's when you can go on to gain awakening. So that answers your question. How do we gain insight in jhana? Mm-hmm. Any questions? Yes?
How important is it to have a kind of an intellectual understanding of jhana and, you know, these descriptions of how to work with them before you experience them?
My teacher liked not to explain this to his students. And I think what had happened in his case was with the John Lee, as I told you earlier, the forest monks had to convince the people in Bangkok that jhana was still possible. That's one of the reasons why he went in and he was teaching. And you look at John Lee's books, and he's very upfront about this is how you do jhana, this is the different jhanas. And so that accomplished that purpose. Now, John Fuang began to notice that people started comparing their jhanas. I was on this retreat with so-and-so, and I got the third jhana. How about you? Which is not helpful. And John Fuang found that it's not really necessary to know that much in advance. It was helpful in his case. I mean, he was there teaching people, so they were in a certain spot. And he would say, okay, I tried dropping this. Which means if you don't have somebody sitting there with you, it's good to have a little bit of knowledge in the background. But don't be constantly referring to it. Because one of the things that really destroys a person's practice is to think, well, I've got this jhana, let's go on to the next one. I've got 15 minutes, I've got more time. What you want to do is stay where you are. Until you begin to see, oh, this part of it is unnecessary. It's like a child learning how to walk. When you first walk, you move your whole body. Because you're not really sure which muscles are necessary and which ones are not, but you just use the whole thing. And as you get better and better, you begin to realize, okay, I don't have to move the whole body. I can just move my legs. And then I don't have to, and then you get more and more efficient, and you begin to sort of separate it, made out which things are necessary to walk and which things are not. And so it doesn't have to, you know, then you start, you can walk and chew gum at the same time. And it's the same with the jhana. You begin to realize, okay, I've been doing all this thinking and adjusting and everything. Wait a minute, the breath is about as good as it's going to get. I don't have to adjust it anymore. Let's just be with it. And you see, okay, I can stay with that. It doesn't require the adjusting. In the beginning, it required the adjusting, because if you didn't adjust it, you were out. Mm-hmm. But as you get better and better, you don't need that anymore. And it's kind of realizing, like, I don't need that crutch. I don't need that brace. I can walk more and more efficiently.
And then I suppose reading about it too, once you've experienced going back, that can also help you with that.
That helps you again. Oh, this must be where it was. Because the only one of the four that actually has a, which you might say is an objective measurement, is the fourth, where your breathing stops. Mm-hmm. And it really does. You're there, you're very still, and there's no sense that you need to breathe at all. You're not holding your breath, you're not suppressing it. It's just there's no need. Now how that happens physiologically, I don't know. I've heard different theories. One is that you're actually getting some oxygen exchange at your skin. You probably saw a Goldfinger, right?
No.
No, okay. You know the story?
No, I don't know okay. either. But was it something about getting kind of painted?
Painted with gold, yeah. Yeah. And in the story, she dies. Apparently, I talked to somebody who said she wouldn't have died, she just painted. That's interesting that you faint by having your pores, your pores covered. They learned the same lesson in Laguna Beach. They had this thing called the Pageant of the Masters. Ever heard of this? It's this crazy Southern California thing, where they will try to recreate famous paintings and famous statues on the stage. So like a Hogarth painting or something like that. We get everybody all dressed up and we get the background and everything. And for the statues, they go down to the beach and find all the good people with good-looking bodies. Mm-hmm. And they say, okay, we'll put you up on the stage and we'll cover you with white paint. And you can be Venus or you can be David or whatever. And they discovered the first time they did that, that David came around on the revolving stage and after 5 minutes, painted. Which is not a very inspiring sight. And they realized they had to leave a whole patch of the back open, uncovered with paint. So that may be part of it. You also notice as you get into this that there's that, when you talk about the breath channels in the body, there's a feeling that they're all connected. Like every possible road through your body is all connected. So if there's any breath you need in any part of the body, it'll be supplied by other parts of the body. So you don't really need to breathe. So it's good to have a little bit of knowledge in the background and then just put it down and focus on the breath. Mm-hmm.